They were traders. That she was sure of now. And returning along the road from the east. So there was little doubt in Robin's mind as to what they had traded for these paltry wares. Slavers, she snapped. In God's name and mercy, these are the slavers we seek. Returning from their filthy business, Juba, go and hide immediately, she ordered. Then, with her Sharp's rifle tucked under her arm, she stepped out through the opening in the wall of thornbush, and the nearest warriors in the circle lowered their shields a little and stared at her curiously. This small change in attitude confirmed Juba's guess. Their intentions were not warlike. "Where is your Induna?" Robin called, her voice sharp with her anger. And now their curiosity gave way to astonishment. Their ranks swayed and rustled, until a man came from amongst them, one of the most impressive men she had ever laid eyes upon. There was no mistaking his nobility of bearing, the arrogance and pride of a warrior tried in battle and covered in honours. He stopped before her, and when he spoke, his voice was low and calm. He did not have to raise to be heard. "Where is your husband, white woman?" he asked. "Or your father?"
"I speak for myself and all my people."
"But you are a woman," the tall Induna contradicted her. "And you are a slaver," Robin flared at him. "A dealer in women and children." The warrior stared at her for a moment, then lifted his chin and laughed. It was a low, clear, musical sound. "Not only a woman," he laughed, "but an insolent one also." He shifted his shield onto his shoulder and strode past her. He was so tall that Robin had to lift her chin to look up at him. He moved with a sinuous balance and assurance of carriage. The muscles in his back shone as though they were covered in black velvet. The tall plumes of his headdress nodded, and the war rattles on his ankles whispered with each pace. Swiftly he moved through the gap in the thorn hedge, and at Robin's gesture the Hottentot corporal lifted the point of his bayonet into the present position and stepped back to let the Induna pass. With a sweeping gaze the Induna took in the condition of the camp and laughed again. "Your bearers have run," he said. "Those Mashona jackals can smell a real man a day's march away." Robin had followed him into the camp, and now she demanded with anger that was not feigned, "By what right do you enter my kraal and terrify my people?" The Induna turned back to her. "I am the king's man," he said. "Honor the king's business." As though that was all the explanation that was necessary. Gandang, the Induna, was a son of Mzilikatsi, the king and paramount chief of the Matabili and all the subservient tribes. His mother was of pure Zanzi blood, the old pure blood of the south. But she was a junior wife, and as such Gandang would never aspire to his father's estate. However, he was one of his father's favourites. Mzilikatsi, who mistrusted nearly all of his sons, and most of his hundreds of wives, trusted this son, not only because he was beautiful and clever, and a warrior without fear, but because he lived in strict accordance with the law and custom of his people, and because of his unquestioned and oft-proven loyalty to his father and his king. For this and for his deeds, he was covered in honours to which the ox-tail tassels on his arms and his legs bore witness. At 24 summers, he was the youngest Indoda ever to be granted the headring of the Induna, and a place on the High Council of the Nation, where his voice was listened to with serious attention, even by the old grey-pates. The ageing king, crippled with gout, turned more and more towards this tall and straight young man when there was a difficult task or a bitter battle in the offing. So when Mzilikatsi learned of the treachery of one of his Indunas, a man who commanded the border guards of the south and eastern strip of the burnt land, he had not hesitated before summoning Gandang, the trusted son. "Bopa, son of Bakweg, is a traitor." It was a mark of Gandang's favour that his father condescended to explain his orders as he issued them. "At first, as he was ordered, he slew those who trespassed in the burnt land. Then he grew greedy. Instead of killing, he took them as cattle
and sold them in the east to the Putukezi and the Sulumani, Portuguese and Arabs, and sent words to me that they were dead. The old king shifted his swollen and painful joints and took snuff before going on. Then, because Bopa was a greedy man, and the men with whom he deals are greedy also, he began to seek other cattle to trade. On his own account and secretly, he began to raid the tribes beyond the burnt land.
Gandang, kneeling before his father, had hissed with astonishment. It was contrary to law and custom, for the tribes of the Mashona beyond the burnt land were the king's cattle, to be raided only at the king's direction. For another to usurp the powers and gather the booty that belonged to the king was the worst form of treason.
"Yes, my son," the king agreed with Gandang's horror. "But his greed was without frontiers. He hungered for the baubles and the trash which the Sulumani brought him, and when this supply of Mashona cattle was not enough, then he turned upon his own people."
The king was silent, and his expression one of deep regret. For though he was a despot, with powers that were subject to neither check nor limitation, although his justice and his laws were savage, yet within those laws he was a just man.
"Bopa sent to me messengers accusing our own people, some of them nobles of Zenzi blood, one of treachery, another of witchcraft, another of stealing from the royal herds, and I sent the messengers back to Bopa, ordering him to slay the offenders. But they were not slain. They and all their people were taken along the road that Bopa had opened to the east. Now their bodies will not be buried in this land, and their spirits will wander homelessly for all time."
This was a terrible fate, and the king lowered his chin upon his chest and brooded on it. Then he sighed and lifted his head. It was a small, neat head, and his voice was high-pitched, almost womanish. Not that of a mighty conqueror and a warrior without fear.
"Take your spear to the traitor, my son, and when you have killed him, return to me."
When Gandang would have crawled from his presence, the king halted him with one finger raised.
"When you have killed Bopa, you and those of your Amadoda, who are with you when the deed is done, may go in with the women."
It was the permission for which Gandang had waited for so many years, the highest privilege, the right to go in to the women and take wives. Gandang shouted his father's praises as he crawled backwards from the royal presence. Then Gandang, the loyal son, had done what his father commanded. He had carried his spear of retribution swiftly across all of Matabeleland, across the burnt land and along the hyena road, until he had met Bopa, returning from the east, laden with the spoils he so dearly coveted. They had met at a pass through a line of granite hills, not a day's march from where Gandang now confronted Robin Ballantyne. Gandangs in Yati Impi, in their ostrich plumes and civet-tail skirts, carrying the dappled black and white oxhide shields, had surrounded the slave guards formed from selected warriors of Bopa's in Khrambeni Impi. The slavers wore white egret plumes and kilts of monkey tails, while their war shields were of chocolate-red oxhide. But right was on the side of the Inyati, and after the swift Jikela, they raced in to crush the guilty and confused slave guards in a few terrible, unholy minutes of battle. Gandang himself had engaged the grizzle-headed but powerfully built Bopa. He was a wily, scarred fighter and veteran of 1,000 such conflicts. Their shields, the one dappled black and the other red, collided with a thud like charging bulls, and they wrestled for the advantage until Gandang, the younger and stronger, with a shift of weight and feet, had hooked the point of his shield under the red shield of Bopa and prized it aside to open his enemy's flank.
"Inkidla!
I have eaten," Gandang sang out, as he sent the broad blade cleaving between Bopa's ribs. And when it was withdrawn against the reluctant cling of flesh, with a sucking noise like a man walking in thick, ankle-deep mud, Bopa's heart-blood burst out behind it, and splattered against Gundang's shield, drenching the oxtail tassels on his arms and his legs. Thus, it was for good reason that Gundang had laughed when Robin called him a slaver. "I am on king's business," he repeated. "But what do you do here, white woman?" He knew very little of these strange people, for he had been a child when the impis of Mzilikatsi had fought them in the land to the south, and had been driven by them northwards into what was now Matabili land. Gundang had met only one or two of them. They had been visitors to his father's great kraal at Tabas in Dunas, travellers and traders and missionaries who had been given the road by the king and allowed to cross the strictly guarded frontiers. Gundang was suspicious of them and their gaudy trade goods. He distrusted their habit of breaking pieces off the rocks along their path. He disliked their talk of a white man who lived in the sky and seemed to be in serious competition with the Unkulukulu, the great god of the Matabili. Had he met this woman and her followers in the burnt land, he would have followed his orders without hesitation and killed them all. However, they were still 10 days' march from the frontier, and his interest in them was casual. He was impatient to return to his father and report to him the success of his expedition. He would not waste much further time. "What is your business, woman?" "I come to tell you that the great queen will no longer allow human beings to be sold like cattle for a few beads. I come to put an end to this evil business." "That is man's work," Gundang smiled. "And besides, it has already been seen to." The woman amused him. At another time he might have enjoyed bantering with her. He would have turned and strode from the camp when suddenly a small movement seen through a gap in the thin thatch of one of the temporary shelters caught his attention. With uncanny speed for such a big man, he ducked into the hut and pulled the girl out by her wrist, holding her at arm's length, and studied Juba gravely. "You are of the people. You are Matabili," he said flatly. Juba hung her head, and her face had a pale, greyish sheen of terror. For a moment Robin thought that Juba's legs would no longer bear her weight. "Speak," Gundang commanded, in that low but imperious voice. "You are Matabili." Juba looked up at him, and her whisper was so soft that Robin hardly caught it. "Matabili," she agreed. "Of Zanzi blood." The warrior and the maid considered each other carefully. Juba lifted her chin, and the greyness vanished from her face. "Your father?" Gundang asked at last.
"I am Juba, daughter of Tembu Tebi.
He is dead, and all his children, at the king's orders." Juba shook her head.
"My father is dead, but his wives and his children are in the land of the Sulumani, beyond the sea. I alone escaped."
"Bopa!" Gundang said the name as though it were a curse. He considered a moment. "It is possible that your father was wrongly sentenced, for Bopa sent false accusation to the king." Juba made no reply. But in the silence that followed, Robin saw a subtle change coming over the girl. Something altered in the carriage of her head. She shifted her weight, thrusting out one hip, a small but provocative movement. Her eyes, when she looked up at the tall Induna, grew wider and softer, and her lips were held slightly apart, so that the pink tip of her tongue just showed between them.